Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Tech Weekly, the technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week we are swept up in a wave of hype as we deconstruct the most anticipated press conference of 2010.
We'd like to show it to you today for the first time, and we call it the iPad. So, it's very thin. And what this device does is extraordinary.
That was Steve Jobs on stage. Bobby, was he wearing a black polo neck?
Turtleneck. Yes.
Yes, he was. Good. I'm glad you made that. You made that that prediction last week. Anyway, was Steve Jobs giving it the big look at this with the newest Apple toy, the iPad, when it was announced. A whole lot of hot air or the next evolution in techno gadgetry. Let the debate commence. The studio is also buzzing with the escalating row between the dead tree publishers Macmillan and ebook peddlers Amazon. Did the virtual bookseller draw a line in the sand by removing all of Macmillan's books from its shelves at the weekend? We'll be debating the future of publishing and the iron grip that Amazon has over the old media on this week's show. Joining me to tackle these issues are Charles Arthur here in Guardian Towers and Bobby Johnson down the line in San Francisco. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Charles. How is your thumb this week? Last week you had an interaction with a chainsaw, I believe.
Not a chainsaw, happily, because otherwise there wouldn't be a thumb to be looking at. It's all gradually necrotizing, and I'm sure I'll sort of look like something out of True Blood pretty soon.
Ugh, grody. Get some True Blood in you. And Bobby, were there other predictions that you got right apart from the black turtleneck, polo neck?
Well, given that I was loath to make predictions and was extremely conservative, I think I probably did okay, but I don't like being wrong, so I just pretend that I don't want to answer any questions.
That's a very good tactic, Bobby. Well, we'll also be taking a look at this week's headlines, and we'll be hearing your thoughts from the blogs. Stick around for the next 30 minutes and prepare to be enlightened. It was the most hotly anticipated press conference of 2010, but did it disappoint, or has it shown us new technological vistas? The Apple iPad was launched last week, and we've been sifting through the reactions that have saturated the web since last Wednesday. Now, Bobby, you've had a play with the thing. How was it for you?
Yeah, I got about 15 minutes last week in the crush of people trying to get demos. I think that the first thing to say is that I don't actually think Steve Jobs is... demos and presentation did it justice. The second is that he's either got really small hands or there's something weird going on, because as soon as I got my hands on it, it was smaller than I thought from seeing it on the stage. But you know, everyone's looked at it by now. What you need to know, I suppose, is that it's very comfortable. It's light, it's intuitive to use. It's familiar to anyone who's used the iPod Touch or the iPhone. Good for surfing, good for apps. Keyboard is a bit crap. It's going to be uncomfortable if you want to do any real typing rather than just finger jabbing on the sofa. The screen's good, you can read on it. And it's pretty fast, not lightning fast, but fast enough for some things. All in all, I mean, it's very impressive to use. The questions that still remain are what people are going to do with it.
Well, joining us to debate the highs and the lows of the next must-have gadget is author and technology commentator Nick Carr. So, Nick, we've heard what Bobby had to say about actually touching the machine, but really, what is it? Is it a glorified phone? Is it a netbook, a movie player, a media device? What do you think it's going to be used for?
I think what Apple hopes it becomes is what comes after the PC. More and more, we use our computers as media players or media devices. And what the hype surrounding the iPad showed us is that there's a yearning for a new kind of device, a new kind of interface that will bridge, you know, audio, high definition video, games, and all the other stuff we want to do with our computer. And Apple pretty clearly thinks that, or hopes that the iPad is that new device, and that we'll all move toward it as our default media player. So something that not only complements or replaces the PC, but also the television and all the other devices that we used to use to fool around with the media.
If it is a new dawn, then that throws forward questions about how we will use it, what it can be compared to. There are several people on Twitter that we asked who wondered about the balance between creation and consumption on this new technology. And one of the people who follow us says, John Satriani says, what should we be comparing the iPad with?
It is essentially, to use those terms, a consumption device, a way to play media, listen to media, and so forth. And that doesn't mean that, you know, inventive software developers aren't going to figure out ways to open it up to more of a production role. But given, you know, the limitations on inputs and so forth, and as Bobby said, the limitations even on the keypad, it's very much a gaming, TV, books, media device. What we're seeing is the computer, which was always very much a production device, an interactive device, is, in the at least in the guise of the iPad and other similar tablets, moving more in the direction of traditional media, a traditional relationship with the audience where stuff is served up and viewed and listened to and read.
Nick, on your blog at roughtype.com, you wrote a post after the iPod was released, and you said it was sort of goodbye to the PC. And I think that you pointed to the fact that tablets have been around since 2001, running the Windows Tablet Edition, and yet they haven't done well. And that maybe that's because Microsoft is trying to make them too functional a device, that actually it's a sort of a space where you don't want something that does everything. And, I mean, it seems to me that Microsoft's actually very bad at stripping functionality away, and that the interesting thing Apple has done here, because the way that it was presented in the presentation was it sits between your phone and your computer. It's a sort of in the same sort of space as netbooks, that it's trying to create a device that strips away lots of the things that people have done with computers and just tries to get you down to the really simple things so that you could give it to your grandma or whatever and she'd be able to use it. I mean, that seemed to be what you were suggesting in your blog post, is that it's post-Microsoft.
And as you say, Apple's quite good at that, and often gets criticized when a device first comes out for the limitations it imposes. You know, the original iMacs didn't have floppy drives and so forth. And what you realize afterwards is exactly what you said, that Apple is trying to encourage a different kind of mode of use by imposing limitations and going in the opposite direction of Microsoft, which is enamored of feature bloat and loading things on. Having said that, you know, one question that still is out there is whether, in fact, people do want tablets. Because, you know, this is a new kind of tablet, but it's still a tablet, and nobody has bought those things for the last 10 years. And the question that remains to be answered is whether it's going to work, whether it's going to become a mainstream device or remain kind of a device for a niche.
The intriguing thing was that rather than saying it's fulfilling a function, was that they were aiming it at the price point. I mean, netbooks have been the explosive seller in the whole PC space in the past year, and Apple was aiming the tablet, the iPad, right at that space.
I think that's absolutely right, although I still think it's about twice the price of a netbook.
And I think the other thing that I found interesting, this is a completely daft point, but was that when Steve Jobs has previously unveiled things, he said, and today we're unveiling, you know, we call it iPod. And when it was the iPhone, it was, and we call it iPhone. But this one was the iPad. And I thought, oh, he doesn't like it very much.
Well, one of the things that's been a really interesting trend with the iPhone and with Apple's other products are the apps. And Bobby, I wanted to ask you about this because you commented on this. There were some developers who think that this iPad is actually going to choke innovation in the development community. How and why is that?
Well, I think this is one of the big open questions here. Is what if the iPad becomes a sort of handy computing device for normal people, then what can you do with it and what can't you do with it? And everything has to get channeled through Apple's approval process. You know, the App Store, we've seen huge problems with people sort of developing on spec and trying to get things through iTunes and then failing, and often for reasons that seem arbitrary or don't make a lot of sense. Now, I think if you're actually saying this is a computing device of some description, not just a handset, then there's going to have to be some more transparency there. Is the argument put forward by Jonathan Zittrain in his last book was that there's this kind of conflict between generative devices that allow you to create things, and this brand of sort of consumer device and appliance that just does one job, or it does the job that whoever makes it wants. And that's the tension in the iPad. I think if it creates a new generation of devices that replace netbooks or low-end laptops, how do you cope with not being able to do stuff in the way that you want? And how does the media industry cope with Apple owning yet more channels of distribution for books and things like that?
Nick, one final question, and it's from one of the Twitterers. Sandy L. asks, if it was made by anyone else but Apple, would there be half as much hype about it?
Probably not. As we saw from the lead-up, Apple has and Steve Jobs has a unique ability to get people a bit crazy about their products. And in some ways, the actual reaction to the iPad shows the danger in that approach, because the device that was imagined by all the people writing about it and hyping it up beforehand was actually a more interesting device than the one Steve Jobs actually showed us. So in some sense now, Apple is dealing with the fallout from that, which is a general sense of disappointment, at least among the most technically connected crowd, that the iPad falls short of what everyone was hoping for.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. We're looking forward to seeing how all this plays out. In the meantime, here's Bobby with the other headlines that have caught our eyes this week.
The Conservatives have pledged to upgrade Britain's broadband to super fast speeds if they win the next election. The plan, which involves breaking BT's monopoly and up to £1 billion of money from the BBC, should encourage the adoption of lines running at up to 100 megabits per second by 2017. In the wake of the hacking attack that hit Google and other technology companies, organisations are beginning to question support for Internet Explorer 6, the 9-year-old web browser that's still popular in many large businesses and government departments. Google said it's dropping support for IE6, while the Department of Health has told doctors and hospitals that they should do likewise. Whistleblowing website WikiLeaks has shut down temporarily as a result of what it says is a lack of funds. The site, which has hosted controversial documents such as the BNP membership list and a classified report about the activities of oil company Trafigura, claims it requires £372,000 each year to keep running. And finally, Bill Gates continued his mission to save the planet by pledging $10 billion to help supply vaccinations to children in the developing world. The Microsoft co-founder, who stepped down from his day-to-day role at the software company in 2008, says he hopes the world's biggest single act of philanthropy will save as many as 8 million lives.
Charles, what's the claim here with the broadband and conservatives issue?
Well, the Tories are saying that they would take 3.5% of the licence fee and use it to raise between £750 million and £1 billion, given there's 25 million TV licences at around about £120 a year, and that they would use this to, it's not quite explained how, encourage, along with breaking BT's monopoly on the local loop, to sort of lead to, in some rather unspecified way, people having up to 100 megabits per second connections at home. It doesn't quite hang together for me, I have to say, because if you break BT's monopoly on the local loop, okay, so who's going to come in and take it over? How are you going to get them to provide everyone with 100 megabits per second?
Charles, wait, break this down for me. The local loop. This is a bit of jargon that I'm not familiar
with. Okay, the local loop. You have your exchange that the number comes into, and then you have the local loop, which is the line that goes from the exchange nearby you, sort of within a couple of miles, if you probably, to your home. And that is called the local loop.
So how will what the Conservatives are proposing actually break this down? And what does this say about what they think about what the BBC is doing now?
Well, no one knows quite how they're actually planning to make it happen. This is the problem. There's no real incentive. This is always the problem about fibre and high-speed connections, is where is the financial incentive for any sort of telecoms company to bury money like this in the hope that it's going to flower into a return? The capital return on these sorts of infrastructure projects is so far off that you generally need governments to put big amounts of money into it, you know, really tens of billions, and the sort of £1 to £1.5 billion that this would, this levy, this top slicing levy, which in itself is unpopular, top slicing the BBC license, it's just not enough. So one has to say that this is one of those ideas that I think is makes a nice headline, but the reality is a bit tougher.
Bobby, I'd like to go to you to the WikiLeaks story now. It sounds to me like they've run out of cash. Is it such a problem that WikiLeaks does not exist on the web?
Well, it's interesting that WikiLeaks has really carved itself a niche over the past few years of being this place where that sort of avoids various legal jurisdictions and sort of fulfills the promise of a borderless web. You know, if there's something that a document that's potentially illegal in one country or suppressed in one country, then WikiLeaks is the place you go to find it. And for journalists, it's become quite an important resource. What they're saying basically is they're spending more money than they can cope with at the moment. And like Wikipedia, which is obviously the model that they follow, they're doing a fundraising drive. Wikipedia's fundraising drive is usually extremely successful. They just had one where they raised millions of dollars. WikiLeaks, however, I think is really going to struggle to bring in cash from people because it has this reputation as being slightly shady and beyond the reach of the law, and therefore harder to generate cash from the people who use it.
Which is journalists, isn't it?
Yeah, well, journalists notoriously tight.
I was actually going to say that myself. Almost those exact words, Bobby, I was going to say that.
And news organisations who aren't exactly rolling in clover at the moment, those are the people who would actually, who would be best placed to fund WikiLeaks.
And it's also the association with some of these potentially quite dodgy, you know, dossiers that are coming up as well.
What we're seeing really is the reality that actually it feels like it should be free to host information, but actually it's not. And once you start factoring human bodies into the equation and people who run your site and keep it up and running and hosting costs and bulletproof serving and all that kind of stuff that WikiLeaks has to deal with, it actually becomes a more expensive business than you expect. But that won't stop somebody else stepping in the short term and trying to replicate it.
That is an excellent point, Bobby. Thank you very much. And you can read up on all these stories on guardian.co.uk/technology. Late last week, a row escalated between the book publisher Macmillan and virtual bookseller Amazon that has recalibrated the food chain and the literary ecosystem. All of Macmillan's books were removed from the Amazon shelves in the United States because the two companies couldn't agree on the price consumers should pay for their ebooks. Macmillan wanted the price to match the sale value of their paper copies, while Amazon's price for their ebook reader version was substantially less. In the end, the bookseller capitulated to the publisher and has replaced their titles on their site. But what does this mean for the power brokers in this industry and for Amazon's potential control over the literary word? Joining us to discuss the implications of this row is Claire Alexander, a literary agent with Aitken Alexander and a woman with quite a substantial history in publishing, as well as editor-in-chief at Macmillan. Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thank you.
Claire, talk us through Macmillan's thinking. Why was it important for them that they actually escalate this with Amazon?
Okay. What has been happening is that we've all been talking about digital rights for some time. Amazon launched the Kindle, which is a bespoke piece of equipment that only they had. And they've been driving people to buy the Kindle by offering book content very, very cheaply. And what that means is that they have in America been default pricing to $9.99. That is it's pricing way below a hardback. So what they've done is make it extremely attractive from a price point of view for people to default to an ebook rather than a paper book. And there are enormous rewards for Amazon in so doing. It's quite cheap for them to present books to people as a download, as opposed to lots of white vans driving around countries with packages in them. And I think people need to remember that Amazon for years did not make a profit until they totally dominated the whole realm of books that were sold on the internet. And what publishers were seeing was a real impact on their book sales, on their physical book sales. You know, there had been an argument that e-books would be incremental. They're not incremental. They may not be copy for copy, but publishers have been seeing an erosion of the actual physical sale of books and people moving on to the Kindle.
What is fascinating is that I read somewhere that 1/6 of the Amazon stock comes from Macmillan. So one would think that Macmillan would have the upper hand by default.
As it turns out, you're right, because Macmillan did have the upper hand, although not perhaps because I don't know the proportions, even if it were 1/6. Where Amazon was vulnerable was not because they are actually monopolistic at the moment, but where they were vulnerable is that they've already taken a beating for when they've taken books off people's Kindles after they'd bought them. So they must have thought initially that they had the upper hand, Amazon that is, but then on reflection realized that this was a PR own goal. Because by taking off the buy button, the consumer was not being given the choice.
Now, how important is Amazon to booksellers and authors? Ultimately, how much of a grip do they have on distribution versus, say, a Barnes & Noble or a Waterstones or an independent bookseller?
It will depend on the type of book. But, for example, in the British market, for a work of serious nonfiction, Amazon might be as much as 70% of the market.
Whoa.
For a more popular book, they might be 12%. So it absolutely varies according to the type of book. But they have become the most singly powerful internet bookseller. And in many cases, the most singly powerful bookseller.
Absolutely. That's quite terrifying, Charles.
Surely Amazon was selling these at a loss. That wouldn't be a sustainable model for them, would it?
It has been selling them at a loss. The first thing to remind you is that the Kindle, as I said, is a bespoke piece of equipment. So they're making money on the device. Mm-hmm. The second thing is again, Amazon have shown in their business model that they're prepared to take a loss for a very long time in order to dominate a sector. And they did, if you remember, they didn't make money for years when Amazon came into being. So they are quite used to this notion of losing money in the short term in order to be the monopoly in the long term. And they pretty well achieved that, you know.
Do you think that this move over the weekend, because it all played out really very quickly from Friday night through to Sunday night, do you think that this is actually the publishers winning this battle? Or is this something where Amazon's going to go away and think about it and come back?
I think Amazon have a number of problems. If we back wheel a bit from before the Macmillan story, it was only a week before that there was a story that Ian McEwan's backlist was going to be on sale via Amazon directly and not through his traditional publishers in America, and that they were paying a higher royalty than the publisher would. So there's a lot of battling going on, you know, about who owns those rights, whether the publisher does in the backlist or whether the author does, whether an author is better with Amazon or with their publisher or on their own. And the other thing that Amazon is very, very aware of, which I think is the sort of elephant in the room, is Google. Because Google are going to launch something, I gather, later this year, which will compete head-on with Kindle. So I think Amazon are trying to position themselves because they're about to have a major competitor.
How much leeway is there? I mean, legally, there's a recommended retail price. Surely Amazon can really legally set its price wherever it wants. And if it decides to be bullish and carry on with this in the long term, what happens? Does it just force its way into the market?
I'm not a lawyer, but in fact the English market and the American market are different. So we have no retail price maintenance in England. And in fact, unfortunately for publishers and authors in some ways, in England we preach the free market and we bloody well have it. In America they don't really. And there are checks and balances, which is quite clear from the way I'm talking about it. I happen to think is a good thing. So in America there is something called predatory pricing, which is illegal. So they're not free, actually, to price wherever they want if what they're actually doing is trying to drive other people out of the market, which I think is what they are doing.
I suppose that Macmillan and other publishers could refuse to sell their e-books through them, couldn't they? They could offer their normal books and refuse the e-books.
They They could do that, but equally, you know, for certain sorts of books, as I was saying, this is, you know, the only game in town. And even for books where they're not the only game in town, they're certainly, you know, they're a significant part of the market. So I think everyone, including Amazon, are walking this tightrope between trying to keep business as usual, because we are all in bed together, but also trying to end up with a business model which is sustainable for the future, which is just what the music business failed to do.
Claire, I wondered, do you think that Amazon will eventually try and root around the publishers? I mean, you represent authors themselves, and as you said, you know, people are starting to make deals that sort of cut the publisher out of the loop completely. Are we going to see more of that coming down the line?
Basically, what Amazon will do will be to try and make unique deals with people that fit the profile of what they want to sell. Evidence in America, which is quite interesting, is that the sort of people who are mostly buying ebooks are either businessmen or women at home. In fact, they're finding there's an awful lot of women like reading romance fiction on ebook, which nobody had foreseen. But what Amazon will never be any good at is they're a retailer, they're not a publisher. So I think as a good agent, you have to balance looking after the best interests of your clients with not destroying an ecosystem which enables you to develop talent for the future. Amazon aren't going to, they are saying they are, and they're very smart. So they are offering, as well as they're offering the brands, they are offering unpublished authors that they can be available on ebook via Amazon. But that's unmediated, and a lot of it will be junk. You know, so I think that it's dangerous for agents and authors just to turn their back on the publishers and think we can get a better deal with Amazon. You can get a better deal with Amazon, particularly on the brands. But then what do you next do when you find a sort of undiscovered masterpiece?
Charles, finally, is there a link, would you say, between the timing of this row and Apple's iPad announcement?
Well, certainly Amazon, having previously gone for a 70-30 split, where it got to keep 70% of the price on ebooks, suddenly flipped and went to a 30-70 split, the same as Apple, just as Apple came up with his iPad. And it has to be said, I mean, Claire mentioned Google as an elephant in the room. I think that Apple is also quite a large presence in the room.
That's the gorilla.
Yeah, well, it's a gorilla, but also I think you find that Amazon have said that books available on Kindle can be available on the iPad. So they're aware of that, but I don't think they'll be quite as welcoming to Google.
Thank you very much, Claire Alexander from Aitken Alexander. And for more on this, head over to our website, guardian.co.uk/technology. What's been rumbling on the blogs, Bobby?
Well, I can't go without mentioning the iPad again. The post I wrote last week, in which we sort of detailed a lot of what the iPad doesn't have, largely because the reaction to it was sort of all a bit meh. You know, people were really sort of unimpressed and looking at all the things it was missing. I'm not necessarily sure those are problems, as we discussed earlier, but there was a real split between people who thought it was a terrible idea and people who thought it was the second coming. So two comments from people. Psychedelic, who said, it's an utterly pointless device at the moment and about as useful as the spork.
I love my spork.
I was going to say, it's unfair to the spork.
Yeah.
I mean, the spork is a
inherently useful device.
The best ever headline that never made it into The Onion was Man Knifed by Spork.
But the you know, we'll give Psychedelic the benefit of the doubt, and we know where he or she is coming from.
Clearly,
but
has never used a spork.
The response from Dave Allen was kind of veered in the completely opposite direction by saying the iPad is Apple's reconceptualization of what a computer is to a regular person, which I think those two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, but they certainly feel that way when you're reading the comments.
I love the internet. It's just the polar opposites. You never get anything down the middle, do you? Well, on the games blog, given that earlier in this podcast, Nick Carr was talking about how the iPad was potentially a games machine and they were talking about the games applications, there was surprisingly little from the games blog about the iPad.
I thought that there would be more. There were a few choice comments, though, on Greg's post about the excitement that some games developers have voiced since the device's launch. And Ivor B says, "You gotta love EA Sports developer Peter Moore's quote. I can see why he's gone so far in the gaming industry thinking outside the box like that. Hey," he says, "if it's got buttons, if it's got a screen, we can put some games on it." He's then critical of it and its sort of anti-ergonomic qualities. And he says, "The laptop screen sits upright so the user can face it directly. Yeah, a tablet would be lying flat on one's lap. So one would have to look downward to view it. This seems like a really awkward position to me, or am I missing something?" And Chaos Teacup quickly replied, "It's made by Apple, Ivor. People will buy it even if it pops your vertebrae." So there you go. You get a little bit of debate on Apple fanboydom and girldom, even on the games blog.
I'm afraid that on the technology blog, the comment I liked is still the iPad. So it's been a pretty iPad-y sort of podcast. Sorry about that, folks, but, you know, that should be enough until March. On the post of iPad bashed by bloggers around the web, there were loads and loads of comments, which I've got to say, people think a bit more. Come on, think. And I thought Green Dave actually hit the spot. He said, "I'm glad it's not the bloggers who design new products. None of them understand the basic principles of selling an item. Apple talk about what the product does rather than what it is made of. I'm so glad I'm not the idiot that writes, 'Ah, if it won't do flash, I'm not buying it.' Hopefully this is the start of having computers as appliances. I know it will be sad for the geeks that normal people will not have to seek their annoying advice about viruses and hard disk upgrades and new video cards. Users will just be able to do their browsing, email, photos, video and games and have one big button to press if things go wrong. The main flaw at the moment is that it's still tied to using a computer to sync. Apple needs to create it as a complete standalone that people who've never had a computer can use so they can join the internet and multimedia new world."
Okay, so there's our middle ground. I like that commentator.
Much Green better Dave, than all of these. Come back.
Come back, Green Dave, rather than the highs and the lows of technology that Bobby brings or I bring. Well, you can keep your eyes on our Twitter feed, which is @GuardianTW, for questions and updates. We do ask for your contributions to our discussions on Mondays before we record the program. And also check out our Flickr group for amusing images of the team. We've got a picture of Charles's thumb, which is now in a better position than it was last week when it looked like he'd smacked it around with a chainsaw. And we've also got a really good one with lots of comments from producer Scott's eating habits. If you'd like to give Scott some advice on how to live beyond the age of 35, then do head there.
He's doing his best Andy Murray look at the moment.
It could be your good deed of the day. Go on, recipes. You can find all the links on our sites, guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Thanks very much to our guests, Nick Carr and Claire Alexander. Three cheers for our in-house potter, Charles Arthur, and our potter at large, Bobby Johnson. And hooray for the guy who pulls it all together, producer Scott. Next week, we'll be dissecting the user-generated encyclopedia, Wikipedia, with founder Jimmy Wales. Tune in on Tuesday for The Dirt. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we'll see you next week.